not just 15%.
8:15, having arrived, I'm going to call the House Education Finance Committee to order. And the first order of business, we don't quite have a quorum yet to do the minutes, so Representative Quam had asked for some information on total funding per pupil and so forth, and was looking for a ranking from highest to lowest. And so I'm just, before we go with our regular business, I'm going to ask Mr. Strom if he would just take a minute or two just to go over that, and then members, we can look at that on our own later on. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Quam had asked a question about the chart that one of the presenters handed out that showed the equity gap, which is a statutorily defined creature. That gap only measures three components of revenue. It measures basic formula allowance, equity, and referendum revenue. That's what's in the statute for the department to measure the gap between the 5th and the 95th percentile. We've passed out other spreadsheets this year that have shown total operating revenue and general education revenue, but the question that was asked was on the equity revenue. There's two spreadsheets in your printout, district-by-district listings, that are sorted. The only difference between those is one is sorted on a pupil units basis, that's the weighted pupil units, and the other is sorted on an ADM or unweighted pupil basis. So if you look at the one that says sorted most to least by weighted pupil units, it's got the slightly lighter top on it. What you'll see there is a rank order on these three characteristics: basic formula, equity, and referendum. And you can see how the range varies from most to least on that measure. And that corresponds to the chart that was passed out in the hearing the other day.
Very good. And so, Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the base general education revenue that was handed out before, it is quite a bit different than what... why are they picking this as the parameters instead of the base general revenue? It seems to have quite a bit more detail and information in it, and I don't think it shows the fuller discrepancy with cherry picking portions.
Mr. Strom, and again, as Mr. Strom said, I think the question yesterday was to the chart we saw that had the differences in equity, and that's what Mr. Strom is presenting you is under statute, what is included, what revenue sources are included. But if you might, Mr. Strom, what is not included? Mm-hmm. It would be some of the big items.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, the big items that are not included, those components of general education include things such as compensatory revenue, which is about $500 million statewide, LEP revenue, all sparsity revenue, all those other components of general education revenue are not included, nor are things like special education revenue. And I think it raises the question of why we asked the department by statute to measure this particular gap in funding. The department may have some comments about that, but when that provision was passed in the early 90s, in part, I think the idea was, what is the equity formula working to counteract and somewhat balance the referendum revenue component? So it wasn't so much, in some ways, a total look of the system. And I think there was also some thought on folks' parts that the other components of spending, like compensatory and sparsity and things, were driven by a characteristic which by definition were creating variation.
Right.
But it's an excellent question about whether this is really the best measure of gap that we could put in statute.
So, Mr. Strom, what we're seeing here under the statute would be things that where everyone's sort of on the equal page. So you're not going by free and reduced. You're not going by the size of the district, or you're not going by the second English learners and so forth. It's things that would kind of be equal across the board.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, and I think really when one thinks about it, the referendum revenue is the thing that varies, and the equity put in, I think, in some ways to counteract that variation in referendum. But you can see here that this gap, even on just these three characteristics, is still quite large. Interesting, the relative rates, that a few years ago the legislators were interested in looking at what would happen if we added additional components. There was some movement, but surprisingly less movement than we thought when we added other components of general education revenue into the mix.
And we'll be seeing more of these spreadsheets as it goes on during the year. Representative Quam, anything else on that? Before we
no, I guess I'm pleased that the chair is open to looking at maybe improving if this is equity revenue and ways to adjust it, have it in a more agreed upon broad, because I don't think that this obviously what we're doing for equity adjustment is not I guess fair across the state in the opinion of many districts. That's why they've got the organization to seek greater equity, and I think has been stated by several members of this committee that they feel that there still is too much of a inequitable gap. So, but no, thank you for enlightening me on what they choose to use to run the formula off of versus some of the other spreadsheets that we normally work with.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Quam. At this time, I would like to call on Ms. Johnson if she would go through the spreadsheet that we will see in the House here. And this is the governor's recommendation that were put out. So, Ms. Johnson, we'll spend about 10 minutes with this, if we could.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertas.
Just point of order. Do you want to take care of the minutes before we start the presentation?
That would be... Representative Hertas, I believe then you would like to make that motion.
I will. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have a Representative Hertas moves to approve of the January 29th, 2013 minutes. Do we hear any discussion? If not, I'm going to call for a vote on those minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Hertas. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to direct your attention first to the spreadsheet that's on legal size paper. That's titled 2013 Session Appropriation Tracking. And this spreadsheet should look very familiar to you. It's the one I walked you through a couple of weeks ago, but I wanted to give you just a brief orientation again. The spreadsheet is set up by typically how the omnibus education bill is put together by article, so the first section being general ed, education excellence, special education, and so on. The columns across the page orientate you to the fiscal years. The first set of columns then is for the current biennium and fiscal 12-13. The next set of columns is the base, and these numbers were updated for the November forecast and will again be updated for the February forecast, but these are the numbers that we compare all proposed changes to. And then, as you'll see, as promised, I'm adding columns as we go for the governor's recommendations and how those compare to base. The last column is critical, and it helps you to really quickly, at a glance, see where the differences are in what the governor's proposing versus the base. As you are well aware, the governor is recommending $344 million in new spending for the biennium. And as you can imagine, because the general education component is such a big portion of the overall bill, as you look at line 38, you'll see that the governor is recommending about $173 million in just this component alone. And I'll get into the specifics in lines 5 through 33 in just a moment, but I just wanted to cue you into that. So if we look at lines 5 and 6, the basic formula amount, if you follow that across the page to the governor's recommendation, you'll see that's where the $52 increase in the formula allowance is plugged in. And if that you then go down to line 11, this is where you'll see what the net or the incremental cost for that formula allowance increase would be. In fiscal 14, you'll see it's about $46.4 million, and then in 15, $64. It looks like it's kind of a big jump, but we have to remember that the spreadsheet is based on appropriations and not entitlements, and we're still in a shift environment where some of that entitlement will spill over into the following fiscal year. So that amounts to about $110 million. And then, I won't talk too much about it, but in addition to the formula increase the governor's proposing, he also has a number of general education formula changes that he wants to starting in fiscal 15. These would include things like simplifying the pupil weighting, eliminating the marginal cost pupil unit, and establishing a separate declining enrollment component to the formula, changes to the referendum calculations from a resident pupil basis to a basis where of actual students served, and tweaks to the equity revenue formula, a roll-in of categorical aids like gifted and talented and extended time, elimination of the aid reduction for retirement contributions, and then an overall transition revenue adjustments to make sure that the governor's proposal wouldn't, the districts would be assured the same level of funding as under current law. Getting on to some of the other specifics of the governor's proposal, on line 12, you'll see this is the optional all-day kindergarten initiative. This would increase the pupil unit weight for all-day pre-kindergarten from 0.55 to 0.7. This would amount to about a $910 per student increase in funding for districts that choose to participate in free all-day, everyday kindergarten programs. This would start in fiscal 15 and would be about $40.2 million going forward from fiscal 15. And as the Chen suggests, about 50% of districts are currently offering it, and the projection is that this incentive may induce districts to increase that participation rate up to about 85%. Then the next line, line 13, is the teacher growth and evaluation. This is funding to support the new teacher evaluation model. In fiscal 14, there's about $1.4 million on a pilot basis to get that initiative up and running. And in fiscal 15 and forward, districts that are not involved in the QComp formula would be entitled to $22 per student for getting the teacher evaluation model up and running. On line 14, you'll see the English language learner. This is in response to the task force recommendation to extend that period from 5 to 7 years that additional time is needed to get the kids up to speed given the rigor and requirements, and that would be about $8.9 million for fiscal 14-15. Line 15 is the early grad scholarship program. This was implemented in 2011. It awarded scholarships of between $2,500 and $7,500 to students who graduate early, and the amount would increase the earlier the students graduate. The governor is recommending repealing this program due to low participation and redirecting the $428,000 in resources to higher demand programs. Line 16 is the clarification of the kindergarten early entrance requirements. This would provide clearer criteria on the admission policies for children under the age of 5 years old. There's been some uncertainty in the past or different uses of this, and so this would help avoid enrolling children too early and having them to have to repeat the grade over again. And this would result in a small savings of about $2.8 million. On line 17, you'll see a line for I grouped in property tax changes. As you'll see when I go over the levy spreadsheet, that one of the governor's overarching goals was to hold the property tax levy harmless with regard to his education proposal. And so I'll get into a little bit more about what those changes reflect in that section.
Ms. Johnson, could I ask you just to kind of cover, because we'll be coming back to this, just some of the really major areas here, because I really want to get to the task force report in like three minutes or so.
Mr. Chair, members, obviously these are the big dollar amounts, but the other big amounts are in line 65, special education funding. I know that Dr. Mitchell will be talking about those changes. That's about $124 million increase. The other big ticket item, line 119, is the early childhood scholarships. Additional $44 million that would be included in that program get the program going farther than it was in 2011. And then there are some minor tweaks to the Department of Education budget for regional centers of excellence, bullying prevention, and special education paperwork reduction that have an impact, and some minor ones to the state academies and the Perpich Center. So you'll see overall on line 209, the $344 million overall increase there. And then I don't have too much to say about the levy tracking spreadsheet. Again, the governor's hoping to hold the property tax levy harmless. And a lot of the changes on about the middle of the page where it says governor's rec current law difference, that is where you'll see that the differences between what the governor's proposing and the base. And a lot of the differences are a function of the proposed change that I mentioned regarding the general education formula and the aid and levy mix for those. The referendum one is, you'll see on line 17, is a big one, and that has a lower impact of property tax of about $5 million due to changing in the way that the students are counted for referendum dollars. And I think that's about it. So overall, the net effect is about almost $5 million in fewer and less property tax over this period.
Ms. Johnson, thank you so much. And members, if you do have more specific questions later on, feel free to ask Ms. Johnson or Mr. Strom on this also. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you bet. Representative Woodard.
Just a quick question from Ms. Johnson, and it's a overview question, so I think it fits your criteria. So what is the cost of not paying back the shift? And there's an additional cost associated with that. I think you called it the shift spillover. Do you have a number there? I see we're getting close because of the aid property tax payment shift and the property tax recognition shift lines on 215 and 217. But do you have an overall number of what not paying back the shift will actually cost in this biennium?
Ms. Johnson.
I do know that these lines on 215 to 221 show, because the formula amounts are increasing or the overall spending is increasing, there's additional shift savings. And so all of that would be in addition to the other.
Sorry. Yeah, I think,
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as you're aware, there's $550 million of aid payment shift left to repay and $550 million of property tax recognition shift left to pay. In each year that we go out, as the property tax base grows, property taxes grow, school property taxes grow, on line 215 there, you'll see that that number is generating additional savings. So that's essentially the cost of not paying it off now, is that we're gaining that additional amount of savings and we'll have to repay that additional amount. So, for example, in on line 215, if you go to the November forecast for fiscal year 14, you can see there's $16 million, negative $16 million. That's savings to the state of not repaying the property tax. Whenever that property tax shift gets repaid, that additional $16 million will get added to the $550 million. So if we were to wait 1 year, add that $16 million to the 550. If we waited 2 years, you would add that $16 million plus the next column, the $22 million. So we'd have an additional $38 million left to repay. The same basic premise holds true for the aid payment shift. As the aid entitlement grows, the portion that we're saving is increasing each year that it's not repaid as well. So we're garnering essentially additional savings by not repaying right away. And when we do repay, we'll have to repay those savings as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strong, that's very helpful. So, and I get it. So it's the $61,812,000 plus the $90,623 on line 221. Right, so it's basically $151 million if you add those two together. That's where those numbers come from.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Mr. Strom.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Strom. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Quam, quickly.
Yes, this is more of a point of information. So what is being stated as savings is what Education Minnesota referred to in the last year as taking money from our kids. So that's money that's not going to the schools, and that's what we're calling savings.
Mr. Strom, I don't know who really.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think I think it's certainly fine to use whatever terminology one wants to use with that. I know this was a very contentious issue over the last couple of years. For our tracking purposes, which is what this spreadsheet shows, we indeed are getting state savings because the shift percentage is at 82.5% and not 90%. If it were at 90%, we would not be getting those savings. So it's less expensive for the state to fund a first year of any program or any growth because it shifted at 82.5%, not 90. Now, when the February forecast comes out, if there's additional funds there, so the shift goes up to 88%, all of these numbers will change, and the savings we'll get from those will be less. So the whole underlying baseline there is going to change when the February forecast comes out. But it's certainly fair to call them savings from the state point of view, and I think your terminology is certainly fair terminology as well. But this purpose of this is merely to give us the state accounting to balance out the K-12 spending to the state total so that we know how much spending we've got.
And members, we have a number of bills that have been introduced that deal with the shift, and so we will have a day here where we will hear those bills and talk much more in depth on shifts. So we will certainly be addressing that issue. All right. Thank you, members. Dr. Melcher, if you would come forward, and Ms. Ciccone, we now have the Department of Education here to talk about the school finance trends and issues. The Education Finance Working Group recommendations, many of these recommendations, as we know, made its way into the governor's recommendations. So, Dr. Melcher, if you would introduce yourselves, and please begin.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the State Department of Education. And with me is Mary Ciccone, who was one of the members of our working group. And I believe Mary will be starting off with some background on the working group.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Ciccone.
Good morning, Chair members. I'm Mary Ciccone, Parents United for Public Schools. We're a Minnesota-born, parent-led organization that's focused on education. And the working group started in 2011 during the spring. And at that time, Dr. Melcher led us through the various studies that had been done up to that point, beginning actually even before Governor Pawlenty's group in 2003. And then we had a Hamline study in PS Minnesota and some national work. At that time, the group did come up with several recommendations, but it was too late to affect any change in the legislative process. So in 2012, the commissioner reconvened the group and added several members. And at that time, we began with the recommendations from 2011 and then changed them based on the work that was done here at the legislature. And then we worked through 2012 on many of the recommendations that Dr. Melcher will walk us through today. We also went out to over 11 locations around the state presenting the various components. And then at that time, we took their information and came back and made changes. Several of the things that the task force surprised at and wanted to try and balance was the cross-subsidy for special education, the loss of state equity funding, the fact that we were levy dependent, and they wanted some sense of stability for funding for schools. The commissioner had several very specific recommendations from the beginning. These were priorities. The group was to focus on how the funding formula could support students and their results. She was very clear that she wanted the decisions to be made closest to the delivery of service. We needed to meet the state's commitments in statute for what they said that they would pay for. We were to try and provide greater flexibility, preserving local controls so that locals could use those dollars to the best service. It was to be more transparent, rational, and comprehensible, and be structurally sound, yet nimble enough to try and deal with the emerging issues that are coming forward for schools. So with that in mind, We went ahead and did have several recommendations. I do want to point out that while these recommendations went a long way in trying to balance and stabilize a system that has gone out of whack in the last 10 years, one of the things that was brought up over and over and over again, both in the committee and also in 9, at least because I was at 9 of the 11 outstate events, was adequacy. As much as this may balance and stabilize, there was still the question of adequacy issues, unmet needs, the technology issues, and the issues of class size. That type of thing came up over and over again. But that, of course, was outside of the purview of the committee and actually is back in your hands. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions about the makeup of the group or what their thinking was. But obviously, Dr. Melcher is the one who can answer the tough questions.
Thank you so much, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ciccone, did your group ever define adequate or adequacy?
That was not...
Ms. Ciccone.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, Representative, that was not in the purview. That was not one of the issues that we were to tackle, but we kept coming back to it. So, yes, it's a difficult one. What we did determine was that the state has developed standards. The state has developed proficiency marks, and the state is the one that defines resource. So what we believed was all of those needed to be in alignment. That would be adequacy.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Ciccone. Just a couple of real quick questions here. You'd mentioned the definition of local control that the task force looked at was to allow districts to be flexible with their dollars. Did you talk about local taxpayers having control over the levy process as well? Is that part of the definition of local control?
Ms. Ciccone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, actually there was a lot of concern about the lack of property tax fairness because of what has happened to the state equalization formula over the years. So that was much more of a compelling conversation.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cohen, okay, so the definition of local control did not include control by local taxpayers. And was there a minority report as well? And was there any dissension on the final report?
Ms. Ciccone?
Mr. Chair, Representative, first off, I'm not sure that actually was my answer. The question was property taxpayers certainly have a position in deciding for their schools the dollars, but without property tax fairness, which is the state equalization formula, they would actually, it's not just their willingness, but it's their capacity to make the same commitment to their schools. That was the conversation around the table. As to your second question, we took the clickers, I don't know what they're called, I'm sorry. The vote was done by clickers, and all except two members voted in support of these recommendations. I do not know who the two members were. No one did. But after the report was done and filed, the State Chamber of Commerce did present a letter. And in that letter and in testimony since, what the Chamber of Commerce said is that they were concerned. One of the recommendations was to bring back the general ed levy. And the Chamber was concerned if that happened and other tax changes occurred, they did not know what the total cumulative results of that would be.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I appreciate that answer. I guess going back, because I want to make sure I clearly understand what you're saying on the local control piece. The local control piece you're defining as the capacity of local taxpayers, not necessarily the willingness of local taxpayers to support levies. So what I'm getting at is the position on the definition of local control has to do more with local control over capacity as opposed to local control over voter-approved levies, as an example.
Ms. Ciccone.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to expand briefly on the questions by Representative Woodard. When you're talking about many of the rural districts and you use capacity as a measurement of ability to level the equity as opposed to the voter willingness, as you framed it, I'd like you to consider the fact that many of the rural districts disproportionately are, if you will, burdened with higher values because of larger parcels of land and acreages. We've got the farm situation where ag prices have or land values have been going up significantly, which we've heard in the Property Tax Committee. And I think it's more incumbent to look at the household income and the ability to service that debt rather than just measuring tax capacity, because what we've got in many of the rural districts, we see growing values or larger values because homes are situate on larger parcels of land, which inherently make their value more, but it doesn't necessarily relate to the ability to pay or household income. And so you know, just having a, referring to it as having a higher tax capacity and the ability to resolve equity differences isn't quite the same. And to just make the point, you could have $500 million of tax capacity in a school district that might comprise 500 households, or you might have $500 million that composes 3,000 households. And so the ability to pay is really part of what should be brought into this calculation when you're talking about trying to level the equity between rural districts and urban districts.
Ms. Ciccone, yes, so there was any discussion on those districts that might be property wealthy, but income
Mr.
poor.
Chair, members, that is precisely what we talked about. The fact that the property wealth in a district is reliant on commercial and industrial and all of these, but it disadvantages a resident more to have to pay in an area with low property wealth. The burden is too much on the property owner. That's precisely what we were talking about. So the idea that in an area with high property wealth, a home might only have to pay $140 in order to net a certain dollar for their schools. Someone in a more rural area in a home would have to pay $443 for that same dollar. That is precisely what we were saying needed to stop. That's what we mean by your capacity. The homeowner's capacity to be able to pay as much as three to four times what someone else pays to get the same dollar in their school. That's what I mean by the state equalization dollars having been threaded away has brought us to that point. That is precisely the concern that we had. So it's not just a voter willing to give the dollars for their school. It's actually their ability to pay in a low property wealth district.
Representative Hertaus?
Yeah, I think that kind of answers my question, but I think essentially, you know, we kind of beat this to death because so many things, whether it's the local property tax levy for city or for county or for local government, the three areas that normally show up in your property tax bill are always based on the value of the property and has little or no relationship to the ability to pay.
Representative Radinovich.
Yes, along the lines of Representative Woodard and Representative Hertaus' questions, I represent Aiken County, which has a property tax base that's 42% seasonal. And so does that speak to also the question here of equity and you know, the changes in the formula?
Ms. Ciccone.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. Those actions, that's what we were talking about, the 10 years ago, the actions, the big fix, the general ed levy going away, the removal of ag land and cabins, all of those had effects that have caused, I would use the term, destabilizing system. Absolutely. And that's exactly what was, I would say, that the committee, that was their greatest concern. one of their greatest concerns, adequacy of the other.
Representative Radinovich.
Mr. Chair, thank you. What I guess you're saying when you talk about capacity as it relates to my situation is that because 42% of that property is no longer included in those levy referendums, that those people who are voting on the issue, the burden is disproportionately placed on them because such a large segment of the property tax base is no longer included and the equity is not kept up with where we need to be. Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Ciccone.
Mr. Chair, Representative, precisely.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What brought some of this discussion, I think the heart of it, to me a few years ago, the first time that a levy failed in a certain district, there was a letter from a retired lady who said that she was torn because it was the very first time she voted against, but it would have been the equivalent of her phone bill each month, and she didn't have the money, even though the house she lived in and had raised her children in was of fairly decent value, according to the county assessor. Her income didn't correspond to that, and she no longer could afford that. And I think that's part of what we're getting at, rural areas, other areas where the values, I mean, a farmer, if you sell your outfit, you got a lot of money, but you're not a farmer anymore. So I think the point of looking at income, especially in many of the areas where you have a large portion of retired people, would be, I think, a nice, just, and prudent way to look at it, so it's not just what the assessor puts down. So I think it illustrates just how complex this situation of fairness is.
And remember, I think all of your comments here gets to the point Ms. Ciccone made, is how can we lessen our reliance on property taxes to fund education? Back after the 2001 reform, 12% of our revenue coming into schools was from property taxes. Now it's 20%. And back then, after we dropped taxes about $1 billion down to a little under $1 billion, they're right back up to $2.3 billion on education because of decreased the equalization, the destabilization. And so I commend the group for looking at that issue because, I mean, that's what I think all of us are talking about here is, you know, you have seniors, you have others in your communities that support education, but simply look at their realistic financial situation and say, I can't do it. And it's a tough decision that we should not be placing senior citizens and other citizens in our communities who support education. They should not be in that position to have to decide whether or not, you know, to vote out of their property tax pocket. And I think that's an issue certainly we can address here. Representative Hertas.
Thank you. Well, just kind of follow up to what you said is precisely so much of the objection to the general property tax levy on seasonal recreational property and business property. Again, we get to household income and capacity to pay. Oftentimes this burden is falling on those households that are the job creators and just trying to keep things alive. So as we continue to go through this debate, it seems like whenever we provide property tax relief in some form or fashion, suddenly there's this gaping hole, which I go back to when Ventura took K-12, you know, to the general fund. About 80% of the school districts, I think, immediately floated excess levy referenda because there'd be no pain. You were used to paying this amount, so now was the opportunity to seize the moment. And it seems like every time we offer property tax relief, we get ourselves right back to this same situation of property taxes getting back up to where it was, and all we've done is grown government. So it's kind of a frustrating tail chasing the wag kind of deal.
We're gonna. If that's all right, Ms. Ciccone, are you? Thank you. I think we're gonna go. Thank you so much. We're gonna go to Dr. Melcher, and I'm gonna have you pretty much kind of go through this, and maybe you might have some breaks at certain point that we can ask questions.
Yes.
And also, as you go through this report, if you would also inform members of, again, kind of a reminder, which ones made the governor's budget recommendations, which one didn't, and so forth. Dr. Melcher, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What I'd like to do is briefly review some school finance trends and issues that the committee looked at that kind of informed their recommendations, and also some underlying education funding principles that were considered, and then look at the specific recommendations and then how the governor's recommendations compare to those. The committee looked at the trends in education revenue over the last decade, and this is general education revenue excluding voter-approved referendum levies. The blue line indicates that there have been increases on the average from $6,130 per student to $7,331. However, if you adjust for inflation, you will see that there has been a net decrease of several hundred dollars per student, depending on the inflation measure that you look at. School districts, in response to the declining real state funding for education, for general education, have responded by going to the voters for higher school levy referendums. And as you can see, between 2003 and 2013, the state average referendum revenue per student has grown from $352 to $1,035. If you adjust for inflation using the same two indexes, the referendum levy has still more than doubled over that period of time on a per student basis. During this decade, we've also seen some dramatic changes in the nature of the students that are served in the system. The green line on the top is the percent free and reduced lunch has grown from 26% to 37%. The blue line is minority students have grown from 14% to 26%. The red line is special ed students have grown from 12% to about 15%. And the orange line is ELL students going from 3% to about 8%. So we've seen growth in the numbers of students that come to the classroom with additional needs and require some additional programming. State share of education funding did grow significantly from the early 90s with the spike that you see there at 75% occurring in 2003, which was the first year of the Ventura era reforms taking effect. Since then, the state share has dropped from 75% to 66%. You've seen a corresponding increase in the property tax share from 12% to 20%. And down toward the bottom of the page, you'll see the federal funding level has remained pretty stable at around 6% with a small spike there from the stimulus dollars. And other miscellaneous revenues are about 8%. That's things like interest earnings and fees that are charged by local school boards. This is the trend in property taxes. The red line is non-school local government, cities and counties. The blue line is school districts. What you can see is we've had tremendous growth in property tax levies since 2002, with school levies more than doubling from $984 million to $2.3 billion. At the same time, you'll see that the growth rate on the non-school local government has actually been higher than the school increases. That's made it a little more difficult for school districts to pass referendum levies because their city and county taxes are going up as well. This is the breakdown of school levies by major category. The blue line is the uniform general education levy, and from 1950 until 2001, that was by far the largest levy that school districts had, and that was used to pay for part of the basic formula. The green line is debt service, the red line is the referendum, and the purple line is other kind of miscellaneous levies that school districts make. So the uniform levy was eliminated based on 2001 legislation, and since then we've seen steady increases in all three of the other categories: debt service, operating referendum, and the miscellaneous other levies. So you might ask, what are the other miscellaneous levies? Well, in 2002 we had $223 million in other miscellaneous levies. The largest one by far was the health and safety levy, but we also had levies for integration, community education, alternative facilities, career and tech, and so forth. If you fast forward 10 years, you'll see in pay 2011 that had grown to $707 million of other levies, and we have a lot more categories now. And what we see is that there are a number of categories that didn't exist back in 2002, such as the operating capital levy, which is now the largest levy. The state had paid for 100% of operating capital expenses back in 2002, and as a result of state budget problems, we shifted that to the local property taxpayers in part. Also, the QComp levy is a new one. The OPEB levy is a new one. So we've added more categories of levies, and one of the distinguishing characteristics of these new levies is that they're not uniform. So instead of having all school districts making a comparable level of tax effort to raise a uniform formula, we have a variety of levies that are available to some school districts and not others, and they tend not to be equalized, so they depend a lot on the local tax base to raise the funding. Another issue in school finance over the last 10 years is special education cross-subsidies, and that's just a fancy term for the unfunded cost of special education. Back in 2003, the average cross-subsidy was $478 per student. So if we paid you $4,601 on the general education formula, first thing the school district has to do, take $478 off the top to cover the hole in the special ed budget. You've really got about $4,100 to pay for all of your regular programs. Today, that number stands at about $631, so it has increased. If you adjust for inflation, depending on the inflation measure you've used, it's fairly steady. There have been some ups and downs in that over time. One measure that I think is a good indicator, though, is what's the special education cross-subsidy as a percentage of basic revenue? Because school districts are going to have to take money out of their basic general education formula to cover the hole. And what we've seen is an increase from 8.8% in 2003 up to 12%. So now when we pay you, your school districts, the $5,224 on the formula, the first thing they have to do, okay, let's take 12% of that money and ship it over to cover the hole in our special education budget. So the situation has gotten worse over this period of time. We talked a little about referendum levies earlier, and what's happened over time is that the state share of referendum revenues has declined. In the wake of the Skeen lawsuit in the early 90s, the state initiated a property tax levy equalization program to try to create a level playing field for school districts across the state when they go to the voters to pass referendum levies, so that you'd have a similar tax rate no matter where you are in the state. Depending on your tax base, the state's going to kick in a portion of those dollars. Well, we were in the mid-30s as far as the percentage back in the 90s. By 2004, we were down to about 25%, and we've seen a continual decline since then. We're currently at about 11% of the referendum levies being covered by the state. The state also initiated debt service equalization in the wake of the Skeen lawsuit. Traditionally, we were in the 10 to 15% range. By 2003, we were at 6%. Now we're at about 2%. So it becomes more of a challenge for low-tax-based school districts to issue bonds to repair their school buildings or to add on when they have growing enrollment. So what's happened to the equity measures? You looked at some equity statistics in the early part of this hearing. Back during the time of the Skeen lawsuit, we had a 37% gap between the highest spending districts and the lowest spending districts when we just look at the basic formula, referendums, and equity revenue. And between 1992 and 2003, as a result of the equalization that was introduced along with caps on referendums, that disparity dropped from 37% to 18%. And since 2003, because of more reliance on referendum levies and less equalization by the state, that gap has grown from 18% up to about 31%. You're all familiar with the state budget. I won't belabor that. Of course, we know we have a $1 billion shortfall in the 2014-2015 session. And, of course, you've had a discussion about shifts already. I won't belabor that. But that was part of the things that they looked at. This last slide here in terms of trends is the state and local revenue as a percentage of personal income. This is from the price of government data, and what we've seen over the last 20 years is a gradual decline in the percentage of personal income that goes toward public education. Mr. Chairman, I've got kind of a transition here where I'm going to now talk about some funding principles that were used by the committee.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation, Mr. Melker. Just an observation and then one question. You know, the same way that we see inflation affect school funding, it also affects the incomes of the taxpayers paying for the funding, okay? So their purchasing power of their income is going down at a similar rate. And I think it's wise for all of us to understand that, well, we have a government, this is a bipartisan comment, that perverts our monetary system with huge deficits. And again, previous Republican administrations have also done this. It ultimately devalues our purchasing power of a dollar, and it makes all of our lives miserable, okay? So what we believe we're getting, in effect, we're being shorted when the value of the purchasing power. Now, according to my articles I've read, the purchasing power of our dollars dropped about 30%, which pretty much lines up with your first slide here, from 7,331 down to 5,132. That's my observation, just for everybody to think about. Second is the question. You know, I was in a school district where we went into SOD due to declining enrollment and other things. We wound up about $750,000 in debt, small school district, we were threatened by the state to be taken over if we didn't straighten it out. Well, we tried referendums. They both failed, and the voters said no. So we looked at the structure of how we delivered our educational programs. We went from a four-period day on the 7th and 8th grade level, which I consider to be very inefficient and expensive, and a seven-period day at the 9 through 12 level, to a six-period day, which does eliminate some elective choices. We saved, just on that one change, over $300,000 a year. We also privatized our buses, cooks, custodians, and we made another number of other changes. In 2 years, we went from $750,000 in SOD to a $4.5 million surplus, okay, without a tax increase. So my point is, and my question to you is, do you provide school districts with information as far as the structure on how they deliver education, on how much it would save them if they changed the way they delivered education? In other words, is there a report that goes to a school district that says, here's your cost in delivering K-12 7-12 education if you go with a four-period day versus a seven-period day versus a six-period day? Because most of us on the board didn't realize the amount of savings. And by the way, a six-period day still kept a strong academic program, and we had, knowing GSL School District, we had a strong athletic program. So we were able to do those changes and save that money without a tax increase. So do you provide school districts with any type of comparative data on the structure of how they deliver that education so they can evaluate that?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher. Representative, I believe that the school districts look to the School Board Association and Superintendents Association for that kind of management information. The State Department of Education probably doesn't have the expertise to do good evaluations on that kind of subject. I think that's a very important issue that you raise, and something school districts should be looking at, but probably the State Department of Education does not have the expertise to really provide a lot of help and advice to districts on that.
Ms. Hermanson, you want to introduce
Chair,
yourself?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rose Hermanson, Assistant Commissioner. On policy issues, you know, we have Dr. Melcher here to answer factual questions. I think he's answered it fairly succinctly. We do rely on local school boards to make the wisest decisions about the use of their dollars. If a district is in statutory operating debt, there is a state law, though, that does require them to come up with a plan in order to solve that problem. And we do attempt to work with them as they put that plan together. You know, how they do it and some of the changes they make. This group did not get into structural decisions about the delivery of education. Maybe that's a good thing, something we should look at down the road, but they look primarily at the financial.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Representative Grunhagen.
So based on your response, you're saying that the MSBA, Minnesota School Board Association, or the superintendent would provide them structural as far as you know, or you think that's where it would come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this subject as a guidance to school districts and having them look at what other districts are doing is not one that the department as a whole has sat down and organized staff or advice around. But I do know that school boards, associations, and superintendents regularly communicate with each other about individual issues, about how they change and redo the design of their schools and what they're delivering.
Representative Grunhagen, this is a little bit out of the purview of the task force, and I'd like to stick to this if we could. We've got a few.
Yep, just a comment.
Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chair, maybe it's something we could look at down the road, how structure of delivering the education affects cost for the local school district, because it is eye-opening to see the difference in delivery of a six-period, four-period, and seven-period day.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're fortunate to have Dr. Melcher here, who is one of the most respected people on education finance in the state, I would like to ask him to go over the slide 16 about the school shift. I think this is something that the public is very interested in, and it's important that we have the public trust, and they want the school shift paid back, and I think having your comments on this page would be helpful to the public as well as us.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bernardi, this is summarizing the current status of the property tax shift and the aid payment shift after the paybacks that have been made here. $313 million in March of 2012 and another $1.3 billion in December of 2012. So currently we have a $546 million aid payment shift. As Mr. Strom indicated earlier, that aid payment shift continues to grow each year, and the longer you wait to pay it back, the larger it becomes, because it's a percentage of whatever the total amount of aid is in the system. So as the formula gets increased, you're increasing that over time. And then the property tax shift is a percentage of the levy. Traditionally, school districts have taken the May tax settlement. They put that in the bank, and it's available for the school year starting on July 1st. And with the property tax shift, we've told the school districts, take that May payment and use it for the school district for the school year that's just ending, and then we make an aid reduction the first time we do that. So we've told them to count their property tax money early, and we make a state aid adjustment to take that away. Now, we do have a process in place to gradually pay back the shift as the forecast improves. We're all hoping that the February forecast will improve again and that we'll be able to make another payback, but we don't know that at this point in time. So this is just the current status of where we're at with the shifts. We still owe $1.1 billion, and by the end of 2017, it'll grow to 1.2 something.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Melcher.
All right, Dr. Melcher, I'm going to have you. I think we're going to have him complete this. I want to go over, and if we have questions at the end, we'll have time for that, and you'll be first on.
Mr. Dr. Chair, I have a question that relates to what he just presented, about three questions that I think I should ask.
Representative Erickson, is this on the school shift?
No, it's not on the school shift. It's on the presentation he just made to us.
Okay, I want to get into the actual working of the task force. This is kind of data that leads up to it, and I want to get through that today. So you'll be first on the list when he is completed.
Thank
you. So Dr. Melcher, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, in addition to looking at some of the data on trends and looking at previous studies that had been done, the committee also kind of had in their minds some kind of fundamental principles of what is the state's role in terms of education finance. And the first one has to do with providing adequacy and equity for students, that the state, under the constitutional requirement to provide a uniform system of public education, should ensure that all local education agencies have the resources that are needed to provide an adequate basic education for all students, regardless of where they are in the state, and that includes providing a basic formula that covers the cost of an adequate basic education for students without special needs, and then additional funding for excess costs, such as high-need students, special education as an example, or unique district characteristics, such as sparsity, which causes transportation costs to be higher. They also looked at the concept of equity for taxpayers, And the idea there was that the tax burden to provide an adequate basic education should be uniform across the state, regardless of the local tax base. You can accomplish that either with full state funding of the basic formula, which we do now, or with a mix of state funding and a uniform local property tax, which was the system we had from 1950 until 2001. And that additional revenue to supplement basic programs should be limited in some regards at a reasonable level and also be available equally across the state regardless of geographic location. And to do that, the state should provide some equalization to local property tax levies. In addition to that, the state has a role in ensuring that the funding system is stable, predictable, and provides sustainable revenues over time, that resources are allocated through an understandable statewide formula that is rationally related to the educational need and that also minimizes burdensome paperwork, and that it provides incentives and flexibility for local education agencies to increase the achievement for all learners and close achievement gaps. So those are kind of some general underlying principles. Now, here are the working group recommendations. So first of all, the working group proposed a general education formula of $6,300 per student. That included a $253 inflationary adjustment to try to catch up for some of the loss to inflation over the last decade, a $300 per pupil roll-in of referendum levy into the general education formula, somewhat like the $415 roll-in that occurred during 2001. With the major difference being rather than being funded by state aid, that would be funded with a uniform levy. And there would also be adjustments to pupil weighting changes. So part of the $6,300 wasn't new money. It was adjusting for some lower pupil weights. As far as the governor's recommendations, how they compare, the governor is at a $5,700 formula recommendation, which is a $52 inflationary increase, so $52 versus $250 for inflation, and the governor did not recommend the referendum roll-ins. The committee also recommended a uniform general education levy to help pay for that $6,300. The levy would replace existing school levies that are not fully equalized, including the referendum levy, the Safe Schools levy, the operating capital levy, and so there would be no net change in property taxes. There would be no net change in property taxes against referendum market value or tax capacity. It would be partly based on each tax base so that the total tax statewide would be the same as it is today, but just allocated on a uniform basis across the state. As far as levy equalization is concerned, the committee recommended that some of the equalizing factors that we use be increased to try to bring the state share closer to what it was around 2000 rather than what it currently is, and also that they be indexed to the state average tax base per pupil so that over time we maintain a stable state share of funding for our equalized levy programs. As far as equity revenue is concerned, I want to say that the governor's recommendation did not include the uniform levy or the enhancements to the equalization system. As far as equity revenue is concerned, the committee pointed out that there are concerns about the current equity formula. It does not necessarily target funding to districts with the greatest need. Districts with no referendum at all don't qualify for the sliding scale, so the districts with the lowest revenue don't get the equity funding. There's an arbitrary 25% adjustment for metro districts that's not tied to need. And so the committee recommended a simpler equity formula based on a sliding scale from $100 per pupil if a district had no referendum to zero if a district had a referendum of $1,400 or more. And that would apply statewide, just one simple formula. And the governor's recommendation on equity revenue is very similar to the committee recommendation. The governor increased the high end of this to $2,000, so a district that had a referendum a little higher could still get some equity revenue. But basically, the governor's recommendation was very similar. The governor also maintained a $56 per pupil flat amount for equity revenue, similar to the $46 per pupil amount we currently have, and as opposed to the committee, which would have rolled that into the uniform formula. As far as special education funding goes, the committee was very concerned about the special education cross-subsidy. They recommended a $194 million increase in special education funding to reduce the cross-subsidy on the average from $660 to $415. The governor's recommendation took about three-quarters of that. The governor's proposal would be to increase special education funding by $151 million. When you do the 82% shift, it becomes $125 million in the current budget year, but it's a $150 million increase in revenue to school districts. So the governor's about three-quarters of what the committee recommended in terms of an increase in special education funding. The committee also recommended a change in the funding formula to allocate money partly based on student counts and partly through an improved, fully funded excess cost formula that would recognize all special education costs. Currently, the formula recognizes only salaries as a cost. We do know that fringe benefits are a significant cost of special education programs and that they vary quite a bit among school districts, and that as school districts negotiate with their teachers, some districts put more money into salaries, some put more into fringe benefits. So it can be inequitable to focus only on the salary piece. It also creates some problems of interplay with the federal funding formula, which funds both salaries and benefits. Some school districts have figured out that if they apply for federal aid on the benefits and state aid on the salaries, they can get more money. So we've got some inequities in the system because some districts are better at kind of tweaking their data than others in order to get the maximum amount of state aid out of the system. Another important recommendation from the committee was that we require the serving school district or charter school to cover 10% of the unfunded cost of special education. The state covers about 70% of the total cost of special education under this proposal, and so that would mean 10% of the 30% that's not funded, or about 3%. So we're saying that there's a little bit of responsibility on the part of the serving school district or charter school to cover the cost, and that provides a little bit of an incentive for cost containment on the part of those serving school districts. As far as basic skills revenue goes, the committee recommended the roll-in of extended time revenue into the compensatory formula and allocating it on a flat rate of $260 times the free and reduced lunch count instead of being allocated based on hours of extended time instruction. They also recommended that school districts have more flexibility in allocating compensatory money among sites, allowing districts flexibility with 15% of the money instead of 5%. And they also recommended expanding ELL funding to 7 years for students rather than 5 years, because it often takes longer than 5 years for students to gain proficiency in English. The governor recommendations reflect this pretty closely. The governor's proposal on extended time roll-in does roll the money into the compensatory concentration formula rather than as a flat amount per free and reduced lunch student, but other than that, it's similar. And the governor also recommended the 85% level for compensatory money going to the site and recommended the 7-year ELL program. The committee also recommended some major changes in facilities funding. We currently have a two-tiered system for facilities funding in the state. The largest 25 districts in the state have access to unlimited funding for deferred maintenance without voter approval. They simply submit a plan to the department that identifies what they need to fix in their buildings, and as long as the department rules that that's deferred maintenance and not adding on something new, they're allowed to do that with no limit. The other 320 districts in the state are capped at $60 per pupil unit, plus health and safety funding, which is fairly narrowly defined. It does not cover all of the actual costs of health and safety, and it also requires a lot of burdensome paperwork. The department gets about 25,000 forms in from school districts annually for individual health and safety projects that need to be reviewed. So the proposal here was to narrow some of that gap in funding between the large districts and the other districts. Right now it's about a $250 per pupil gap in funding. And what the procedure was that would be done here would be to increase the deferred maintenance formula from $60 per pupil to $230 per pupil for the districts that don't qualify for the unlimited alternative facilities funding, and to roll the health and safety program into that, so we would no longer be doing the approval of the individual 25,000 projects across the state. The net bottom line was that this would have been a $34 million increase to the smaller districts across the state and medium-sized districts for facilities funding, and then they would have been free to determine whether they wanted to use that money for health and safety projects or for deferred maintenance issues. The governor also, or the working group also recommended, that the facilities recommendations were not included in the governor's recommendations. The regional cost adjustment, the governor also, or I'm sorry, been doing too many governor things. The working group also recommended a regional cost adjustment for the metropolitan area and for larger school districts in greater Minnesota. It would have rolled $400 per pupil unit of referendum money into a new regional equity levy. Most districts in the in the metropolitan area do have higher referendums, and if the truth be told, they're using them to pay for higher costs in the metropolitan area, mostly associated with higher staffing costs. So this would say that's really not the original intent of referendums, which was to pay for extras. Let's move that to a separate category. So that's not new money to the school districts. That's just simply converting referendum to a regional equity levy. Same thing was done for the larger outstate cities at $200 per pupil for school districts with more than 200 students. And then there was also a 1.5% regional cost adjustment in the form of state aid. And this was partly included to balance the increases between the metro area and the rural area. So rural districts were getting a larger increase in the facility side because they have unmet facility needs, and we were trying to balance there. And this was providing an increase in the operating side for metro districts so that they would all receive comparable overall funding increases. With respect to integration revenue, the committee recognized that integration funding does sunset after 2013 if there is no change in law. They looked at the old formula and agreed that it was outdated and doesn't recognize the current distribution of students of color, and they recommended a formula based on $500 times the pupil units times the percentage minority for districts that are required to have a desegregation plan, and they recommended a guarantee of at least 60% of what the district was receiving in 2013. The governor's recommendation for integration revenue is quite similar. The governor basically made two tweaks to this. The first one was to guarantee 90% rather than 60%, and that meant cutting down a little bit on the per pupil rate. And the second one is that the governor added a little piece to his that was based on the focus rating, which is a measure of how well the district is doing in closing achievement gaps. So they're trying to make this partly performance-based. With respect to all-day kindergarten, the committee recommended increasing the pupil weight to 1.0 for students eligible for free or reduced price lunches who participate in the free all-day K program. It was a $63 million recommendation in terms of aid entitlement. The governor's recommendation was somewhat different. The governor recommended a slightly lower amount of money, $40 million, which is $52 million in aid entitlement terms, so slightly less than the $63 million. But the governor recommended that money be spread to all school districts based on a 0.7 weighting. So both groups recommended partial funding for all-day K. I think both would like to really fully fund all-day K, but the resources were not sufficient to do that. And so the difference in approach here was that the committee recommended starting first at, and so the difference in approach here was that the committee recommended starting first with fully funding all-day K for students in poverty, and the governor recommended providing an incentive that partly covers the cost of all-day K for all students in the state. Other changes the committee recommended: simplifying the pupil accounting system with pupil weights of 1.0 for elementary, 1.2 for secondary, eliminating resident pupil units, converting referendums to a rate per adjusted pupil unit. There would be no marginal cost pupil units. That's the mechanism we currently use to adjust for declining enrollment. Instead, we would have a separate declining enrollment component. The governor's recommendations do include these same changes in terms of simplifying pupil accounting. The group also recommended that the aid reduction for pension rate changes be eliminated. That's kind of a frozen subtraction against school district aid based on the amount they saved in 1997 as a result of a change in employer contribution rates. There's been a lot of changes since 1997, and it's just not fair to base school funding on data from 1997. So the idea was eliminate that adjustment, roll it into the general education formula, and simplify the system. Also providing a hold harmless to districts with a below average reduction. The committee also recommended a phase-in of revenue if the total amount of resources was not sufficient to do this in 1 year. The bottom line recommendations from the committee was a $633 million increase in school funding, including $217 million on the formula, $194 million in special education, $63 million all-day K, $34 million facilities, $38 million pension, $52 million for regional equity, and adjustments to compensatory integration and small school sparsity for inflation. These are aid entitlement numbers, so you would take 82% of that if you want to make it comparable to the $344 million the governor has in his budget. The governor, on comparable items, has recommended about $290 million of education increases outside of his early childhood proposal. So the governor's recommending a little less than half of what the committee recommended. The committee also recommended some roll-ins, reallocations, taking some referendum money, adding that to the basic formula or the regional equity, eliminating equity, transition, safe schools, and gifted and talented, rolling those into the formula. That was not new money, just moving dollars to the formula. So the governor did not recommend the roll-in of the basic referendum, of the referendum into the basic formula. Or the equity. The governor did, however, recommend rolling the gifted and talented into the basic formula. So of all these roll-ins, the gifted and talented is the only one that the governor proposed. Bottom line, proposed change in revenue. The committee recommendations would have been about a 7% increase. They also recommended that if we didn't have the resources to provide a 7% increase, that we phase that in over time. The governor recommendations provide about a 3% increase in fiscal year 15. So again, a little less than half of what the committee recommended in terms of average increase in funding. The committee recommended a zero change in property taxes statewide. And to the extent possible, the committee attempted to balance that so there was no net increase or decrease in taxes in the metro area versus rural parts of Minnesota. There were some larger winners and losers in terms of property tax impact in the committee recommendations because of the uniform levy than what is in the governor's proposal. As far as the impact on disparity in funding per student, the committee recommendations would have reduced the gap between the 5th and 95th percentile from about 29% on this measure to 25, about 4% reduction, about a 7% reduction between on the gap between the 99th and the first percentile. A lot of that closure was due to the roll-in of referendum levies. And in the governor's proposal, there's very little change in the gap between the 5th and 95th percentile. As far as property taxes go, the committee recommendations going to a uniform general education levy would have resulted in relatively small increases in property taxes in communities with high tax base per student and decreases in communities with low tax base per student, moving toward a uniform general education levy. Currently, The average taxes are higher in the low tax base districts, and the governor's recommendation really has very little impact on property taxes because they've eliminated that piece that would have rolled in the uniform, the referendums into the uniform general education levy. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that is a quick overview of the committee recommendations, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Melcher. And we have about 12 minutes for questions, so Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, on page 3 of the report from the working group, when you were talking about the general education revenue per student, in your years of employment at MDE, when did we include inflation in our general education revenue per student? When did we include that?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson, the formula allowance gets set every odd-numbered year by the legislature, and there have been many years when I have been at the Department of Education where the legislature has set an increase in the formula that was at or exceeded the rate of inflation. Over the last 8 or 10 years, we have had fewer of those years, and there have been more years where the formula has been kept flat, and I think that has a lot of that has been due to the state of the economy over the last 10 years.
Thank you. And my next...
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question I have is on page 9. Do seasonal recreational owners pay on the non-approved voter levies?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson, the tax levies for schools are divided into those that are spread on referendum market value and those that are spread on tax capacity. And the all types of property pay on all of the levies that are spread on tax capacity. The ones that are spread on referendum market value includes only the referendum,
yes,
the transition levy,
okay,
and the equity levy.
Thank you. That's very important for us to know, those of us who have seasonal property in our areas, and when we're out door knocking, we hear about their property taxes, and I try to explain to them all of this. Then on page, thank you, Mr. Chair, on page 11, on the special education cross subsidy per student, and maybe this is a comment rather than a question of you, Dr. Melcher, but members, I would hope that our literacy plan that we require all school districts to have now for K-3 could reduce the number of students qualifying for special education, and therefore the cross subsidy would be reduced. That's my hope. You know, and just one last statement about, you know, the fact that we're suggesting here that the property tax burden for school districts on our citizens has become too great. What I have found in visiting with my folks is that the more the state does, the less incentive there is for locals to increase our tax base. So when in Mille Lacs County we set about planning strategically for the county for the next 5 to 10 years, and I served on the economic development piece, we specifically said we have to do something about raising our own tax base and not always look to all of the taxpayers of Minnesota to bail us out. And so I think, you know, that's an important message that we carry as we go door to door, or we're now in our town halls, that raising a tax base, luring industry and commerce to our local districts is important to help our constituency understand that that we have a responsibility and for county, city, and school districts, and we can't just ask all taxpayers, especially when we look at the creation of another general education levy, to bail us out. So let's work hard to make our county, our communities, attractive for business and commerce. And that's my closing statement. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, I'm fascinated by the chart on page 17 of the presentation. It would seem that this chart tells a story that parents and students and teachers and administrators are experiencing and school board members are experiencing in their districts. It would appear that in this school year, we are spending less as a percentage of personal income. And I know Representative Grunhagen mentioned earlier that, you know, inflation affects people's personal income as well. But as a percentage of personal income, even, we are spending less than, as far as this chart goes back, which is nearly a generation. If we were, instead of at 4.2% of personal income, if we were at where we were at the high point during the Carlson administration, 5% about of personal income, do you know off the top of your head what that 0.8% would be?
Mr. Chairman, Melcher. I do not. We could easily get that, but I don't know the numbers. Mr. Strom might be able to help me, but I think it's in like the billion-dollar range, but I don't.
Yeah,
and I hesitate to make a comment.
Representative Morgan, I know there's the Price of Government report, and I think you can go to the Minnesota Management and Budget, I think, has that.
Okay.
And you basically, they have a bottom line of the total income of the state, and so you would basically add roughly 1%.
Okay.
And that would be the amount.
I will
I
do
think,
that.
If I'm calculating that right, because I've looked at that quite a bit myself.
I will do my homework, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, but I don't think we have the info right now on that, so... Representative Radinovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions here. My first question pertains to the chart on page 5, which details special populations as a percent of public school enrollment. My question, I can understand most of the trends when it pertains to minority students, limited English, and special education. My question is on the free and reduced lunch. That's something that we've seen in the districts that I represent. Is that a trend, or is that something? Was there a change in the classification as to, you know, what makes a student fall into that category or anything?
Dr. Melcher,
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'm not aware. I know that that there are some changes that occur over time in those requirements, but generally the free and reduced lunch is based on a percentage of the federal poverty guideline. I think it's 185% for reduced lunch and 130 for free lunch.
Right.
So the federal government looks at, you know, the family size and how many members are in families. And I think this is just an indication from what I can tell that we have more families in poverty.
Ms. Ciccone.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Children's Defense Fund does a kids count every year, and they have 50% of children in Minnesota under 5 living in poverty, so it would tend to say that this is a trend.
Thank you. I have another question as
yes,
well.
Yes, Representative Radinovich.
On page 37, as I get to it here, this is the impact on disparity in revenue, and as you had mentioned, you know, right now there's a 29% gap between the 95th and 5th percentile. Previously, I don't have the chart in front of me, but it was a lot lower than that. Was it 18% or something? And then, so my question is, if we instituted the changes of the working group, I mean, the desire would be to see that trend continue downward to the previous numbers. What kind of recommendations would you have going forward to ensure that that was met, or, you know, what would the perils be that we would need to avoid to see that number rise again?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, what you can see, the working group recommendations would have reduced that by about 4%, from about 29% to about 25%. And to get there, what you see is the school districts at the high end of the distribution were getting a smaller increase than the districts at the low end. That's not very, very popular to create revenue increases that are significantly different for different groups. So it's quite painful just to get a 4% decline. And the way that we accomplished the decline in the 90s and into about 2000 was it was a very gradual process where there was a cap placed on referendum revenue, which was fairly low. And there was also a substantial amount of state equalization aid provided for low tax-based districts, which made it easier for them to pass referendum. And that combination, over 10, 15 years, was sufficient to lower that factor from 37% to to 18%. I think it would take a number of years with a similar kind of a policy to accomplish that, both an improvement in the equalization of referendums or less reliance on referendum with perhaps, you know, more than one roll-in of referendum revenue, and combined with some containment at the top end. I believe it was in 2001 or 2002 that the referendum cap was increased substantially. And it was increased because there were primarily in the metropolitan suburban areas a lot of concerns about the impact that those districts had suffered over 10 years because of a lack of growth in their referendum, combined with increases in the general education formula that weren't always keeping up with inflation. And so I think in order to accomplish that, you would have to do something to make the funding more stable so that the school districts felt they could count on some sort of inflationary increases in the general education formula over time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll have Representative Woodward have the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually had a few, so I'm going to narrow it down to a very fun one, I think.
Okay.
I just want to make sure I got this right, Dr. Melcher. You said that the department gets 25,000 forms annually on the Safe School Levy?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Woodward, on the Health and Safety Levy.
I'm sorry,
which is
the Health and Safety.
From the Safe School Levy.
Yes. 25,000 forms. That's I think if my math is right, that's one every 6 minutes.
Dr. Melcher. They come in large packets, and it's pretty much electronic now. But what that means is school districts out there are doing 25,000 health and safety projects, and those can range from a $10 million project to redo indoor air quality to some minor repair that there's one room that's got a mold issue and they want to take out some bad wallboard or something like that. So they range from being very small to very large, and we think that we've got some burdensome paperwork in that health and safety area. That needs to
we might have a bipartisan approach on that one, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, thank you.
And what an excellent way to end this meeting on a bipartisan approach. Members, we are adjourned. Thank you.